darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. In the Book of the Heart Girt with a Serpent, more commonly known as Liber 65, many parables abound which are instructive of Thelemic spirituality. But in Chapter 5, we encounter a parasitical pomp of atheists. I'll look at Crowley's commentary to see how this passage exemplifies Thelemic thought. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Welcome to Darkly Splendid Abodes. This is a little bit of a different take. It's just me today. Usually I'll have a guest, but this time around I wanted to experiment a little bit with the format. We had done a conversation on our Toronto Thelema Discord that was involving one of the holy books, Liber 65, and we chose a portion to discuss, including the commentary by Aleister Crowley on those portions. The conversation was pretty interesting. We had some interesting ideas coming out of it. Rather than recording the conversation itself, which I felt was better to leave in its own sort of private context to what extent it was private, I thought it would be better to record myself going through some of those verses with the commentary and maybe discussing any ideas that happened to come up for me as I went along. Perhaps some of those ideas that we discussed during that conversation might come to the fore as well. Main interest being just being able to delve into the holy books a little bit, and especially with Crowley's commentary, since it brings a lot of ideas to the fore that may not be obvious from the surface level. Liber 65 is five chapters, each of which is attributed to one of the four elements, and the fifth chapter is attributed to the element of spirit. The portion that we chose to talk about was chapter 5, verses 34 to 40. I was motivated to talk about these verses because of the fact that it introduces this idea of a parasitical pomp of atheists, and I thought this was kind of an interesting concept to come into Thelema. The idea of atheists and what that could mean, how it could relate to us, and how it might threaten our ideas of the way that Thelema works. I'll read through the verses first, and then we can backtrack and go through the commentary. Starting from verse 34 and reading on through to verse 40. Also I was in the spirit vision, and beheld a parasitical pomp of atheists, coupled by two and by two in the supernal ecstasy of the stars. They did laugh and rejoice exceedingly, being clad in purple robes and drunken with purple wine, and their whole soul was one purple flower flame of holiness. They beheld not God, they beheld not the image of God. Therefore were they arisen to the palace of the splendor ineffable. A sharp sword smote out before them, and the worm Hope writhed in its death agony under their feet. Even as their rapture shore asunder the visible Hope, so also the fear invisible fled away and was no more. O ye that are beyond our Musdi and Arimanes, blessed are ye unto the ages. They shaped doubt as a sickle, and reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. They shaped ecstasy as a spear, and pierced the ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water. Then the fresh springs were unloosed, that the folk athirst might be at ease. So this is the portion. And to backtrack and discuss it a little bit more in depth, we'll start with verse 34 and the commentary associated with it. I'll read it again. Also, I was in the spirit vision and beheld a parasitical pomp of atheists, coupled by two and by two in the supernal ecstasy of the stars. They did laugh and rejoice exceedingly, being clad in purple robes and drunken with purple wine, and their whole soul was one purple flower flame of holiness. In Crowley's commentary, he says, regarding the verses 34 to 40, this passage is perhaps the most obscure in the whole book. So fun to start with that, if we're going to have a starting place. Hopefully everything else in Liber 65 will become a little easier after this. But as to the verse 34, he quotes the word parasitical and says, they have slain their fathers, i.e. they have won to manhood and the consciousness of the independence of the individuality. I'll note that parasitical isn't specific to the father, but to both parents, or either parent. So parasitical, having killed one's parent or parents, as opposed to patricidal, which is the actual word that would go for fathers. Of course, here Crowley relates it to the father. He then quotes the word pomp, and says of it, they celebrate their attainment of freedom by means of a pageant. They manifest the Godhead, which they have won. So they have won to Godhead, he says. And this is followed by him quoting the word atheists. And he quotes himself here with, Allah is the atheist. He knows no Allah. And this is quoted from his own book, which he pseudonymously published, Bagh-i-Muattar, or The Scented Garden. He says, they are free of the obsession of mortality and dependence. This quote that he uses is pretty interesting. Allah is the atheist. He knows no Allah. And the idea being clearly that because God is God, from God's point of view, there is no God. And so God must be an atheist. This is suggesting that these atheists have attained to Godhead, and therefore they can rejoice in their atheism. He then goes on to quote, coupled, they unite with their comrades in love under will, being equal and identical despite their apparent differences, by virtue of the ecstasy of their common relation to Nuit. Here he quotes several passages from the Book of the Law, and specifically passages from chapter 1, which is spoken in the voice of Nuit. And she particularly says, I am divided for love's sake, for the chance of union. Perhaps it's actually worth reading these verses as well to get some idea of the context of these references. So going back to coupled, they unite with their comrades in love under will, being equal and identical despite their apparent differences. Crowley refers the reader to chapter 1 of the Book of the Law. For instance, chapter 1, verse 2, 3, and 4, which read, the unveiling of the company of heaven. Every man and every woman is a star. Every number is infinite. There is no difference. He also refers to verse 22, now therefore I am known to ye by my name Nuit, and to him by a secret name, which I will give him when at last he knoweth me. Since I am infinite space, and the infinite stars thereof, do ye also thus, bind nothing. Let there be no difference made among you between any one thing and any other thing, for thereby there cometh hurt. Also he refers to verse 50, let the fine be tried in intellect, and the lofty chosen ones in the highest. Thus ye have star and star, system and system. Let not one know well the other. Next he quotes, laugh and rejoice, for which he only comments references to various verses throughout the Book of the Law. Chapter 1, verse 26, then saith the prophet and slave of the beauteous one, who am I and what shall be this sign? So she answered him, bending down a lambent flame of blue, all touching, all penetrant, her lovely hands upon the black earth and her lithe body arched for love and her soft feet not hurting the little flowers. Thou knowest, and the sign shall be my ecstasy, the consciousness of the continuity of existence, the omnipresence of my body. Further, he gives verse 58. I give unimaginable joys on earth, certainty, not faith, while in life upon death, peace unutterable, rest, ecstasy, nor do I demand aught in sacrifice. He then moves to referring to chapter 2, verses 19 to 26. Is a god to live in a dog? No, but the highest are of us. They shall rejoice, our chosen, who sorroweth is not of us. Beauty and strength, leaping laughter and delicious languor, force and fire are of us. We have nothing with the outcast and the unfit. Let them die in their misery, for they feel not. Compassion is the vice of kings. Stamp down the wretched and the weak. This is the law of the strong. This is our law and the joy of the world. Think not, O king, upon that lie that thou must die. Verily thou shalt not die, but live. Now let it be understood, if the body of the king dissolve, he shall remain in pure ecstasy forever. Nuit, hadit, rahur quit. The sun, strength and sight, light. These are for the servants of the star and the snake. I am the snake that giveth knowledge and delight and bright glory, and stir the hearts of men with drunkenness. To worship me take wine and strange drugs, whereof I will tell my prophet, and be drunk thereof. They shall not harm ye at all. It is a lie, this folly against self. The exposure of innocence is a lie. Be strong, O man. Lust, enjoy all things of sense and rapture. Fear not that any god shall deny thee for this. I am alone, there is no God where I am. Further, he gives verses 35 to 44, which read, Let the rituals be rightly performed with joy and beauty. There are rituals of the elements and feasts of the times. A feast every day in your hearts in the joy of my rapture. A feast every night and anew, and the pleasure of uttermost delight. I feast, rejoice, there is no dread hereafter. There is the dissolution and eternal ecstasy in the kisses of new. Finally, from this passage of Liber 65, Crowley puts in quotations the word purple, and says, after giving some further references to the Book of the Law, he says, Purple is the royal color, and that of ecstasy, in particular of the chemical marriage of Nuit and Hadit. In the Book of the Law, the passage is referred to or chapter 1, verse 61, I love you, I yearn to you, pale or purple, veiled or voluptuous. I, who am all pleasure in purple, and drunkenness of the innermost sense, desire you. Put on the wings and arouse the coiled splendor within you. Come unto me. He also gives chapter 2, verses 50 to 51. Blue am I, and gold in the light of my bride, but the red gleam is in my eyes, and my spangles are purple and green, purple beyond purple. It is the light higher than eyesight. Verse 35 from Liber 65, chapter 5, reads, They beheld not God. They beheld not the image of God. Therefore were they arisen to the palace of the splendor ineffable. A sharp sword smote out before them, and the worm Hope writhed in its death agony under their feet. Crowley's commentary reads, This verse carries on the idea of atheists. Confer 2, chapter 1, verses 7 to 9. And if we look at Liber 65, chapter 1, verse 7 to 9, we get, Be not contented with the image. I, who am the image of an image, say this. Debate not of the image, saying, Beyond, beyond, one mounteth unto the crown, by the moon, and by the sun, and by the arrow, and by the foundation, and by the dark home of the stars from the black earth. And this is Adonai speaking in these verses. Crowley's commentary on them is also quite enlightening. Crowley says of them, The angel says each man sees nature in his own particular way. What he sees is only an image. All images must be ignored. The adept must aspire single-heartedly to the smooth point, which sort of refers to Kether at the top of the Tree of Life. If we look at that passage, debate not of the image, saying, beyond, beyond, one mounteth unto the crown by the moon and by the sun and by the arrow and by the foundation and by the dark home of the stars from the black earth. So if one wants to mount unto the crown is Kether. That is what Kether means. And it is at the top of the tree. It is mounted by all these paths that lead up to it. If we follow them backwards in their appearance in this verse, we start from the dark home of the stars from the black earth, the black earth being Malkuth at the bottom of the tree, and the dark home of the stars being the path of Tav, which is attributed to the universe card in the tarot. From there, we would mount unto the foundation, which would be Yesod, the meaning of Yesod, and that is the next Sephira up from Malkuth, directly in a straight line up the middle pillar. From there, we mounteth by the path of the arrow, which is leading from Yesod up into the central Sephira of Tifereth. That path that leads us there is attributed to Sagittarius and the art card in the tarot. Sagittarius being, of course, the arrow, or the bowman who fires arrows. Tifereth being the next Sephira that we reach via the path of the arrow is attributed to the sun. And from there, we mount onto the next path, Gimel, which is attributed to the moon. And this finally leads us up to Kether, the crown, in a straight line up the tree. So hopefully this gives clear meaning to this passage. One mounteth under the crown by the moon, and by the sun, and by the arrow, and by the foundation, and by the dark home of the stars from the black earth. Not otherwise may ye reach unto the smooth point. So reading back in this passage from chapter 5, verse 35, they beheld not God, they beheld not the image of God. Therefore were they arisen to the palace of the splendor ineffable. Crowley says, their natural place being Yesod, whose color is purple, and who I just referred to as the foundation, they, having destroyed the foundation, are arisen to Hod, whose color is also purple. See Liber 777, column 17. Following this reference out, we find the emperor scale of color, which is attributed to Vav of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And if we follow it down to the number 8, we get what would be associated with Hod on the Tree of Life. There we find red russet. We would find deep purple in Chesed, number 4, and very dark purple in Yesod, number 9. But if we follow the number 8 back to column number 15, we will find the king's scale of color, which is attributed to Yod of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And there, the number 8, or Hod, is attributed to violet purple. Now that's kind of interesting, violet purple. Just the fact that this is alluding to the idea that they're associated with this color of purple. And he's attributing them to having been in Yesod, but having destroyed the foundation, and therefore arisen unto Hod, presumably from the emperor's scale to the king's scale. So that would mean rising from Yetzirah straight up to Atziluth, as far as the four worlds are concerned. Those four worlds being Atziluth as the highest in the king's scale, then Bria, the next one down in the queen's scale, the following world being Yetzirah, attributed to the emperor's scale, and Asiya, the next world in the empress scale. Crowley says, the sword is their weapon of intellectual destruction. As in the verse it says, a sharp sword smote out before them, and the worm hope writhed in its death agony under their feet. So the sword is their weapon of intellectual destruction. The sword, magically speaking, is attributed to the intellect and associated with the idea of the reason and intellect. So in this case, they're using the intellect, which makes sense for Hod. I think we tend to think of Hod as being associated with the intellect in many ways and with the idea of conceptualization. Hope, Crowley says, is a crawling worm, being the token of non-realization of one's self as supreme enjoyment. This idea of hope being the worm that they smite before them leads them to this supreme enjoyment. Kind of counterintuitive when most of the time people tend to think of hope as being such an important thing, but this flies in the face of that. Moving on to verse 36, it reads once again, "Even as their rapture shore asunder the visible hope, so also the fear invisible fled away and was no more." And then Crowley's comment only references a poem called "The City of Dreadful Night," which was apparently published in magazines or newspapers sometime, I think, in the 1870s, I believe. I would encourage looking it up and reading it, The City of Dreadful Night. It's not very long. I'll leave it to you to read into it and meditate upon it and see what Crowley sees in it. The idea being here that by smiting hope using the powers of the intellect, one ends up driving off the fear invisible, so that the fear invisible is no more. It seems to suggest that the idea of hope establishes a really strong sense of the self and the not self. So perhaps by hoping for something, you're constantly looking into the future, for instance, and never being quite present. So perhaps by being whole in the present, that's a part of it as well. Verse 37, "O ye that are beyond our Musdi and Arimanes, blessed are ye unto the ages." Crowley's comment says, "In Persian theology, the principles of good and evil, our Musdi and Arimanes." He says, "Confer Nietzsche and our own doctrine, expressed in many ways in many places." I like Nietzsche's idea of going beyond good and evil. And if we look at, "O ye that are beyond Arimusdi and Arimanes, blessed are ye unto the ages." So that, I think, is an important aspect of this as well, in terms of these atheists, this parasitical pomp of atheists. If we are able to go beyond the idea of good and evil, then we can free ourselves from this fear. And I think this is because we naturally are constantly in this state of mind of thinking of something as good or evil and putting it into one of these two categories. And we are always polarized by things. I think I find that it's very common for people to miss the point quite entirely when we're dealing with spiritual writings and that sort of thing. And I find this especially in the case of Crowley, because of the fact that when people read Crowley's commentaries or prose in general, he can be very polarizing in his language and things that he's talking about because, well, for one thing, he likes to be a bit of a provocateur. But aside from that, with the benefit of 100 years of hindsight, we tend to think that we know better in some ways, or in many ways, or in all ways. But this tends to be naive, in my opinion, because of the fact that they thought exactly the same way at the same time, in his time as well, that they knew much better at that point in time. So you can see this when you're reading. You can tell when you're reading somebody who's a little bit more grounded and recognizes the fleeting nature of time and has some kind of humility about the way that they speak about things versus somebody who assumes that they've kind of figured things out and you can put things into all the proper context based on what was contemporary knowledge and understanding and what was trendy in terms of thought. So certainly Crowley was a victim of this in many ways. You could argue that the idea of the aeons is a very late 19th, early 20th century sort of idea. You can see where certain ideas would sneak into Crowley's thinking of that were faddish at the time, that were very popular, that don't really hold water nowadays. But I think that to completely dismiss him or some of his ideas because of this is to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's a lot of what he's getting at is more important than the way that he's getting at it. And inevitably, with language, regardless, you're going to run into some kind of difficulty. It's important not to let our biases prevent us from being able to get at the deeper ideas. So in Crowley's commentary, he says, "Unto the ages," which is the final few words of this verse, "Blessed are ye unto the ages." He quotes that and says, "Leolam," which is the Hebrew that most of our listeners, I'm sure, will recognize from the ritual of the pentagram, where you give the sign of the Kabbalistic cross, in which you vibrate the words Ata, Malkuth, Vegevera, Vegedula, Leolam, Amen. And Leolam is the Hebrew word meaning to the ages, and the value of the word is 176, Crowley says. This is 8 times 22, or 16 times 11, and this means the redemption, 8, of the serpent, 22. Which is the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and the 22 paths that follow the serpentine path back up the tree. And 8, incidentally, is also the number of Hod, which he was referencing in a previous verse. Or, he says, the magical power, which is numbered 11, applied to the blasted tower, which is Atu 16, so that would be taking it as 16 times 11. For whose significance see this comment above? So you can look to the previous comment if you can ever find this comment anywhere. Verse 38, they shaped doubt as a sickle and reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. Now, Crowley gives here in full a chapter from the Book of Lies, chapter 51, which is entitled Terrier Work. I'll read it in full, including its commentary, which is included in the Book of Lies. Doubt. Doubt thyself. Doubt even if thou doubtest thyself. Doubt all. Doubt even if thou doubtest all. It seems sometimes as if beneath all conscious doubt there lay some deepest certainty. Oh, kill it. Slay the snake. The horn of the doubt goat be exalted. Dive deeper, ever deeper, into the abyss of mind, until thou unearth the fox that. I'll just take a moment to refer to this word that. He puts it in capital letters in the Book of Lies, and I believe he's using it to refer to what lies beyond good and evil, what lies beyond the intellectual mind, what lies beyond our normal consciousness. So he says, until thou unearth the fox that. On, hounds, yoicks, tally-ho, bring that to bay. Then wind the mort. His commentary reads, the number 51 means failure and pain, and its subject is appropriately doubt. The title of the chapter is borrowed from the health-giving and fascinating sport of fox hunting, which Frater Perdurabo followed in his youth, the title being Terrier Work. This chapter should be read in connection with The Soldier and the Hunchback, of which it is in some sort an epitome. Its meaning is sufficiently clear, but in paragraphs 6 and 7, it will be noticed that the identification of the soldier and the hunchback has reached such a pitch that the symbols are interchanged, enthusiasm being represented as the sinuous snake, skepticism as the goat of the Sabbath. In other words, a state is reached in which destruction is as much joy as creation. Beyond this is a still deeper state of mind, which is that. So here he's referring to paragraphs 6 and 7, which read, "It seems sometimes as if beneath all conscious doubt there lay some deepest certainty. Oh, kill it, slay the snake, the horn of the doubt goat be exalted." And so once again, he says that it seems it will be noticed that the identification of the shoulder and the hunchback has reached such a pitch that the symbols are interchanged. I should point out that the soldier and the hunchback he refers to, he has a paper that's entitled "The Soldier and the Hunchback," as he says, which I would highly recommend reading. And the soldier is the exclamation point, the sort of aha that breaks down the previous preconception. And the hunchback is the question mark that leads one to find the next exclamation point. This is a series of soldiers and hunchbacks in a line. The Book of Lies actually begins with the first two chapters being just a full page spread each of an exclamation mark and a question mark. Now, knowing that kind of brings to mind some of the imagery that's being used here. And as I go on to verse 39 of this chapter of Liber 65, they shaped ecstasy as a spear and pierced the ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water. Now, that's suddenly it dawned on us as we were reading this together that the soldier and the hunchback, the exclamation point and the question mark, are actually being referred to here in these verses. Going back to verse 38, they shaped doubt as a sickle. A sickle has the shape of a question mark, and reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. And it was pointed out in our conversation that they don't kill the flowers of garlands so much as use them to adorn themselves with. They reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. So it's this idea of reaping the flowers of faith for the garlands but not doing away with faith altogether is kind of interesting. And it made me personally think of something that I like to bring up time and again, which is that I believe that belief is best thought of or used as a tool. Rather than getting too caught up in it, one can think of it as a tool, something that you can take on and invest yourself in, but then put aside when the time for it to be used has passed. And in this case, this is very much what this puts me in mind of. They shaped doubt as a sickle and reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. So they used doubt to reap faith, but then use faith to adorn themselves with. The following verse, they shaped ecstasy as a spear having the shape of an exclamation point. The ecstasy of breaking down those preconceptions, breaking through to something deeper, gradually, constantly, perpetually working towards that beyond, that beyond. They shaped ecstasy as a spear and pierced the ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water. So what is this ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water? Crowley says of the spear that it is the weapon of Sol and Mars. He says of the dragon, the stooping dragon. See the Temple of Solomon the King, Diagram of the Fall, Equinox Volume 1, 2, page 283. If you take a look at that, it's in the place where in the Temple of Solomon the King, the rituals of the Golden Dawn are being printed out in full, and many of the charts and things. And this is the stooping dragon in this case, in this context, using it as the ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water. The stagnant water, in very many places throughout Liber 65, Crowley will comment upon the fact that stagnant water, non-movement, stillness, stasis, these things are in complete contradistinction to movement and velocity and visceral going. And so he likens the stagnant imagery to the path or goals of the Black Brothers. So the Black Brothers are trying to achieve some kind of stasis, which just turns out on analysis to be mere stagnancy and putrefaction. Things don't ever stand still, even if they appear to. Something that seems to be completely frozen in time inevitably at some point in time does experience entropy, some kind of movement. And so what's counseled throughout and is counseled as an important integral feature of Thelema is the idea of movement and dynamism as opposed to stasis and clinging on to something in its form as it is. So he goes on to comment on this stagnant water, the soul in its uninitiated state, passive, corrupt, and motionless, reflecting wrongly the imagery of the non-ego. The Buddhist idea of the mind is identical with this. The words sat and stagnant connect this with the doctrine of the Black Brothers and the theory of the Book of the Law of the universe as going or energy. Then moving on to verse 40, then the fresh springs were unloosed that the folk athirst might be at ease. And here again we have feeling of motion, fresh springs unloosed. Crowley's commentary says, the destruction of this illusion releases the soul to purity and motion, to ease, which is not idleness, but freedom of action, for which men thirst. Pure water is the principle of elasticity, the transmitter of energy. The pure soul is identified with the moving spirit which informs it, reflecting it truly with perfect understanding. See the whole symbolism of the cup, which is Book 4, Part 2, Chapter 7. See in particular Chapter 3 of Liber 65 and Crowley's comment. Chapter 3 of Liber 65 is attributed specifically to the element of water. And that's the end of verse 40. So we have what I feel is some interesting ideas regarding Thelema, covering some of the context of Crowley's thought and writings, and some of the concepts of the Black Brothers and the idea of what Thelema really holds as a doctrine. Perhaps I can read through one more time through these verses now, having read through the commentary, and hopefully it'll give some new insight and shed a different light on the verses themselves. Also, I was in the spirit vision and beheld a parasitical pomp of atheists, coupled by two in the supernal ecstasy of the stars. They did laugh and rejoice exceedingly, being clad in purple robes and drunken with purple wine, and their whole soul was one purple flower flame of holiness. They beheld not God. They beheld not the image of God. Therefore were they arisen to the palace of the splendor ineffable. A sharp sword smote out before them, and the worm Hope writhed in its death agony under their feet. Even as their rapture shore asunder the visible Hope, so also the fear invisible fled away and was no more. O ye that are beyond our Musdi and Arimanes, blessed are ye unto the ages. They shaped doubt as a sickle, and reaped the flowers of faith for their garlands. They shaped ecstasy as a spear, and pierced the ancient dragon that sat upon the stagnant water. Then the fresh springs were unloosed, that the folk athirst might be at ease. And I would like to read one last, before we go away, I'd like to read one last verse. And this I read in closing of our discussion as well, which I thought was fairly apt to keep in mind, since we're sitting here talking so affably about this and discussing this. And I answered and said, "It is done even according unto thy word," and it was done. And they that read the book and abated thereon passed into the desolate land of barren words. And they that sealed up the book into their blood were the chosen of Adonai. And the thought of Adonai was a word and a deed. And they abode in the land that the far-off travelers call not. And I think this is an important reminder that we can sit here and debate these things, but the important thing in the advice of Adonai is to seal the book up into your blood, by which I think Crowley took it as memorizing the book, memorizing at least a particular chapter of the book, which is the work of a probationer of the AA. And if not simply that, or if even not that at minimum, reading the book, engaging with the book, internalizing the book until these passages come to mean something more deep for you. And I think you will find, I mean, for myself, when I first read this book the first time, it meant nothing to me. It didn't really click with me at all. It didn't even poetically seem interesting. It felt I had some kind of revulsion to it in the sense of like not wanting to really engage with it that deeply. And then as I read it over a few times, this dissipated and I began to see the beauty of it, at least in a few passages at first. And then gradually, as I familiarized myself with more and more of the book, I began to see so many beautiful things about it. And as I internalized it, it came to mean so much more. For myself, I memorized chapter 3 for my probationer grade. And so that chapter carries a special significance for me. But this chapter 5, I'm finding, is really powerful as well. And it really seems to carry a lot of important themes, thelemically speaking. Crowley's commentary is really fascinating as well. But either way, I'd just like to remind everyone that we should try to internalize these ideas. We should try to go beyond good and evil. We should try to dig beyond until we find that which lies beyond. Love is the law, love under will. Thanks for listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes.